The first of the two parshas for this week is actually the subject of our consideration twice over the course of the year. It is Parshas Acharemos, but of course the beginning of Acharemos, Vayukra Perek Tet Zayin, is also the laning for Yom Kippur morning. And it's interesting to consider the psukim dealing with the avoda of Yom Kippur from the vantage point of parshanut, of through the mefarshim. And as we know, one of the trademarks and one of the unique facets of the avoda of Yom Kippur is that it allows the Kohen Gadol to enter a place that otherwise is off limits to anyone. And that place is known as the Kodesh HaKodashim. The Mishkan is divided into two domains: the building of the Mishkan, the tabernacle itself. As one enters first, there is the area called the Kodesh. And then deeper in is the Kodesh HaKodashim, the Holy of Holies. What divides between the two is the paroches. And in fact, all of this is really summed up in the words of the Torah itself. In Parshas Truma, V'hivdila ha-paroches lachem bein ha-kodesh uvein kodesh ha-kodeshim. And the kodesh ha-kodeshim is a place that the Kohen Gadol can go only once a year on Yom Kippur. Having said all this, and of course everything we've said is largely well known, it's very interesting to consider the way the Torah expresses it, because the Torah doesn't say exactly what we just said. It says something slightly different. In Perek Tet Zayin Pasuk Beis, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Daber el Aaron Achicha, speak to Aaron your brother, Va'al Yovo Bechol Eis el HaKodesh, let him not come at any time to the Kodesh, mi beis la paroches, which is inside the paroches. Aha. So that's actually already rather intriguing, because we are schooled to know that what's on the other side of the paroches isn't the Kodesh anymore. It's more than Kodesh. It's the Kodesh HaKodashim. That's the whole point. The paroches divides between the two. That being the case, what is the meaning of referring to the area behind the paroches yet as the Kodesh? It should have said, Vayavo b'choles ha-Kodesh ha-Kodashim. That's what we learned in Parshas Truma. Well, there is a fascinating, really eye-opening response to this question in the Ha-Mikdavar of the Netziv. He brings us back to the pasuk in Parshas Truma, V'hivdila ha-paroches lachem, bein ha-kodesh u'bein kodesh ha-kodosh. Okay, what's interesting about that phrase, or that pasuk? It has the word lachem, for you. The question is, in what way is the division of the paroches between kodesh and kodesh ha-kodoshim lachem, for you? Of course, everything in the Mishkan is of benefit to the Jewish people, but then you could have had the word lachem with every single thing. It could have said, and you should make a menorah for yourselves, and the beam should be put into the sockets. Lachem, everything is lachem. But it never says lachem, except here. V'hivdila ha-paroches lachem. In what way is the division between the Kodesh and Kodesh HaKodoshim lachem? And the Netziv responds. As we mentioned, there are times when it is possible to enter the Kodesh HaKodashim. Who would enter there? Actually, at the time, two people could enter there. One within the context of Avoda, and one within the context of Torah. How so? Well, Avoda is the one which we are dealing with now. The Avoda of Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol, would enter the Kodesh HaKodashim once a year. Beyond that, or aside from that, Moshe Rabbeinu would enter the Kodesh HaKodashim regularly. With what in mind? Receiving Torah. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I will commune with you there from the Bein HaKruvim, from between the Kruvim, Hashem Me'al HaKaparis. That means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is communicating with Moshe. Moshe enters there, and Hashem transmits Torah to him. So that's stam important to know, as the Medrash states explicitly, that when we picture in our minds the personalities that enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim, both brothers entered at different times, in different capacities, and for different reasons. The problem is, we know that the Anan of Hashem, the cloud of Hashem, aside from the Anane HaKavod, which enveloped the Jewish people, but you had a much more concentrated, shall we say, or potent cloud presence on top of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And the Pasuk tells us in the end of Parshas Pekudei that as long as the cloud covered the Mishkan, for example, Moshe couldn't enter. That's explicit in the Pasuk. V'lo yachol lavo Moshe lavo el ol mo'ed kishachan alav anan Hashem. Wherever Hashem's cloud, in that most concentrated sense, it hovers over, no one can go. Even Moshe. Says the Netziv, so now we have a problem. I mean, we have a practical problem. Namely, if Moshe, in his context, and Aaron, in his context, need to enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim, but the Kodesh HaKadoshim is defined and characterized by the cloud of Hashem on top, which makes it impossible to enter, so how are they meant to enter a place that's impossible to enter? I mean, that's a good shaila. But all of this brings us back to the words V'hivdila ha'paroches lachem ben kodesh uben kodesh hakadoshim. The word lachem, it divides for you. There's many ways to react to it, but the simple inference is this divides for you between the, this is Hashem talking, this divides for you between the kodesh and kodesh hakadoshim, implying it doesn't divide for me. As if to say, for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the division between Kodesh and Kodesh HaKadoshim is very simply in domains. Those 10 Amos, which are most inner, are Kodesh HaKadoshim. Anything beyond that is Kodesh. It's all about location. But Lachem, for you, it's about the Parochus. So we have two different markers of division. Now, we may ask, well, it doesn't really make a difference because the Parochus happens to be exactly at the point where the 10 Amos of the Kodesh HaKadoshim end and the rest of the Mishkan begins. So what type of a nafka mina is it? That's where the Parochus is. That's where the dividing point is. So what difference does it make that there's two dividers? But it could make a difference. If we could envisage that somehow the Parochus would be arranged so that it is actually at a different place to that cutoff point between the 10 and the 20, you would form a most interesting zone. A zone that in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's terms is no longer Kodesh HaKadoshim because it's beyond the 10. But in our terms, it is Kodesh HaKadoshim because it's behind the Parochus, because the Parochus has been moved in to the Mishkan. Now, all of this sounds highly hypothetical, but it wasn't, because we have a most curious piece of information known to us from the Masorah, namely that the poles in the Aron, which were always there, as we know, even when it was resting, the poles were at the side, they were moved eastward. They were moved towards the Kodesh so that they actually protruded into the Kodesh, beyond the Kodesh HaKadoshim, into the Kodesh, to a distance of an Amma. And thus you have an unusual situation, whereby the Parochus has been moved in. And should we ask, to what end? For what purpose? Now we know. Now you have a place which has the designation of Kodesh HaKadoshim from our point of view, because it's behind the Parochus, because the Parochus has been moved an Amma eastwards. That's where Moshe can stand. That's where Aaron can stand. It isn't the unapproachable or the unenterable 10 Ammas of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which has Hashem's cloud on it, but it's Kodesh HaKadoshim from our point of view, because it's behind the Parochus. What's fascinating is the formation of this zone, if we again pay attention to the finer points of the pasuk and we see all these treasures that are there in, at every step, the words of the pasuk in Parshas Truma again are V'hivdila ha-paroches lachem bein ha-kodesh uvein kodesh ha-kodoshim. What's so interesting about that expression bein ha-kodesh uvein kodesh ha-kodoshim? You see, says Netziv, there are two ways that the Torah can describe dividing between one thing and another in Lashon HaKodesh. There is lahavdil bein A le B, I guess like we say in Havdalah, hamavdil bein Kodesh lechol, bein or lechoshech, so the lamed can be the divider, bein A le B. But then you also have the possibility of lahavdil bein A uvein B, which actually is what we have here. It doesn't say that the parucha shall divide bein kodesh lekodesh hakodashim. It doesn't use the lamed. It uses bein kodesh uvein hakodesh hakodashim. All of a sudden now we realize that there's two dividers, there's two dividing expressions. But why are there two dividing expressions? Says Netziv, because there's two ways to divide. Or more correctly, there are two entities that can represent a division between two things. Perhaps the easiest mashal is if you have two fields, two parcels of land, and you wish to divide between the two. Each parcel of land, well, it's a parcel of land. If you want to divide between the two, you could, for example, put a fence between them. The fence is a divider, but it doesn't partake of their qualities. The fence itself is not land. They are the land. This is, it's almost nothing. It exists only to divide. But the two zones to speak of are the two fields. In between is a fence. But you can also have a situation where two fields are divided by a field in the middle. It's also a division. But what's the difference? The field in the middle is also a field. Says the Netziv, this is the understanding, the crystallized distinction between the Torah's usage of to be mavdo bein a le b, or to be mavdo bein a uvein b. If it's with the lamed a le b, so then that is for a situation where the divider is nothing except a divider. There's only two domains. It's either a or b, and there's something in the middle dividing. That's a le b. But when the Torah says to be mavdil bein a uvein b, that means that whatever divides them is also a zone. It's also something. It exists not only as a division, but also as its own entity. And that's the understanding of why the Torah says that the parocha shall divide not bein kodesh le kodesh hakadoshim, bein hakodesh uvein kodesh hakadoshim. Because that tells us that when not only does the parochus divide between the kodesh and kodesh hakadoshim, but it actually creates a zone that is a middle, literally a middle ground between the two. Because the ama, which is now possible to be created by the discrepancy, shall we say, between the two dividers, creates a zone that is yes and no. It's from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's point of view, it's Kodesh. From our point of view, it's Kodesh HaKadoshim. That's a yes and no. Within the innermost ten amos, it's absolutely Kodesh HaKadoshim. Beyond the Parochus, it's absolutely Kodesh. And when you have both qualities, it has both characteristics. And that's a middle zone. And that's called Bein HaKodesh Uven Kodesh HaKadoshim. So this is the analysis of the Netziv. And from a certain point of view, everything that we have said is borne out once again as we come back to Pasuk Beis. Because Pasuk Beis says, Daber el Aaron Achicha, speak to Aaron, Va'ayavo, and let him not come at any given time. To where? It doesn't say let him not come to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Why not? Because he can never come to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Even on Yom Kippur, the absolute, those 10 Amos on the west, no one can enter there. But there's a certain place that he can enter sometimes. You know what that place is called? It's not called the Kodesh HaKadoshim. It's called the Kodesh behind the Paroches. That's exactly what it is. Because it's actually, yet it's Amma number 20 of the Kodesh. But it has a status for us of Kodesh HaKadoshim because it's behind the Paroches. In the words of the Pasuk, Vayavo b'chol eisa la Kodesh, mi beis la Paroches. So these are some things that perhaps we don't always have time or orientation on Yom Kippur to focus on these aspects, but they're part of the parshanut of the matter. Well, I'd like to move a little further into Parshas Acharemos and discuss something which we have not really spoken about before. It's the idea of Shchutei Chutz, of offering korbanos, the prohibition of slaughtering and offering korbanos outside the Mishkan, or ultimately outside the Beis HaMikdash. And that really is the subject of the beginning of Perek Yud Zayin. So let us have a look there. And it's the subject of quite a few psukim, in fact. And Perek Yud Zayin, if we would describe broadly, the first group of psukim are about the prohibition of slaughtering a korban, shchita, outside the Mishkan. And then the second set of psukim are about offering on a mizbeach outside of the Mishkan. This is known in the parlance as Isor Bonos. That means that when the Mishkan is available, when the Beis HaMikdash is available, it's actually prohibited, and it's a very severe prohibition, either to shecht or to offer anything outside of those places. Daf Yomi has just begun Maseches Vachim. This is the focus of the final chapter of Maseches Vachim. And if we take a look at Pasuk Gimel, we have Ish Ish Mibes Yisrael, anyone from among Yisrael, Asher Yishchat, if he shechts, slaughters, shor, or kesev, or eiz, any of those animals, b'machane, in the camp, meaning not in the, not by the Mishkan. Or Asher Yishchat Michutz l'machane, or outside the camp, which is even worse. B'al Pesach Ol Mo'ed Lo Evio, and he has not brought that as a korban, that's very severe. The pasuk says at the end, "V'nichras aishahu mikerav amo," it's a chiyuv karis, which is it's a very severe punishment. Now, to what does this apply? Shchutei chutz. The pasuk says it applies to an animal that's a korban, so to shecht it outside the base of Mishkan or base of Mikdash is a severe prohibition. Now, animals are not the only korban that require shchita. So do birds. There's korban ha'of. What about them? If that's a korban, is it also a similar prohibition? The pasuk doesn't talk about it openly. But the Toras Kohanim expounds. The Toras Kohanim darshans. From the extra expression, if we look again in pasuk Gimel, it begins by saying, Asher Yishchat, if you would shecht, shor, kesef, eis, O Asher Yishchat michutz l'machaneh. The words Asher Yishchat in the second phrase are redundant because the whole thing is talking about Shechita. It could have said, if Yishchat b'machaneh, oh, michutz l'machaneh. The repetition of the verb Asher Yishchat, says the Toras Kohanim, says, even if the korban is a bird. Okay. Now, we at this point, have a very simple question. If the halacha applies to all korbanos, how come one of them is mentioned in the pasuk, and the other is learned from a drasha? There's two types of korbanos that require shechita: animals and birds. That's it. Of those two, one of them is mentioned explicitly, shor, kesev, eiz, and the other darshaned from the halacha. Why would that be? It seems to be somewhat imbalanced. Mentioned both of them, or if one may ask. So what's behind this? How come one gets the explicit mention and one gets a drasha? Says Meshe Chochma. The background to his response to this question is a well-known position in the Gemara, which relates to something called Bosar Tava. Now the Gemara in Maseches Chulin, in the first parak in Daf Tet Zayin, states that when Bnei Yisrael were in the Midbar, it was actually not allowed to just shecht an animal and eat it in the broader camp of Israel. Any animal that was shechted in order to be eaten, and there was, I mean, they had the man, but they also had this, should they want, had to be brought as a korban. There was a special prohibition for that time of slaughtering and eating any animal outside the context of a korban. That doesn't exist from the time we came into Eretz Canaan. As the pasuk itself talks about in Chumash Devarim, in Parshas Re'eh, this gives us new insight into those psukim. They're summer parshas, but they're still parshas. Where it says, when you come to Eretz Yisrael, Ki achiv Hashem es gevulcha, you'll see, you'll spread out, and you'll see, Ochla basar, I'd like to have some meat, and the Torah says it's okay. just shecht it properly. It's a, why is the Torah saying that? Because until now that wasn't true. Until now, if a person says the answer is to bring it as a korban. There is no other option. The question is, what's behind this prohibition? All of a sudden, if a person wants fleishiks, it's korban or nothing. It's korban or milchiks. Why? Well, the answer is provided by a most interesting medrash. Medrash gives provides a mashal, a parable, to explain the background to this. Vayikra Rabba, mashal leben melech. Gives a mashal to the king's son, shegas libo alav. He was acting in a haughty manner. He was misbehaving. Vayalamed lechol basa nevelus utreifus. And he was eating whatever he fancied, even things that weren't correct or permitted or even good for him. So what's the response? Amar HaMelech, Ze yetadir al shulchani. Make sure that he always eats with me, that he always dines with me. That way we'll be sure that everything he's eating is fine. Ume atzmahu nazir. And then out of himself, naturally, I don't think it means nazir in that sense, but it means he will be separated from things that he should be separated from. Very interesting. In other words, the king wants to be sure that his son is eating kosher. If he's eating out, who knows? So have him eat in. Kach, similarly, says the Medrash. That's what the Jewish people are like. If they slaughter out, If they shech their animals wherever, who knows what their intentions will be? Lefisha Yisrael lehutim achra avodah zara. The Jewish people had yet avodah zara connections. In Mitzrayim they were, and here they are. It's best that it should be in house. It's best that it should be monitored. The pasuk itself said they shouldn't be slaughtering to seirim, to all these other spirits, or who knows what. Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, you makrivim lefanai. If they slaughter an animal, it should be as a korban within the context of the Mishkan. But oil mo'ed, v'im nifrashim mi'avodah zara. That will save them from avodah zara. So this, says the Medrash, is the rationale, so to speak, the reasoning behind the Isser of Basar Taiva. The Jewish people, it's not yet appropriate to leave them to their own locales for shechting animals. Not entirely sure that their intentions will be as they should be. Let it be brought as a korban, and it will all be kosher. Now, it's interesting to note that this medrash is actually brought into the fray of a discussion that we have referenced just a few weeks ago. Namely, the well-known machlokas between Rambam and Ramban with regards to the understanding of what's behind korbanos at all. As we mentioned briefly, just to recap the positions, as we mentioned, the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim states that The Jewish people, they'd seen korbanos, they couldn't relate to religion really without korbanos, and if you don't provide korbanos, they'll feel there's something missing, and who knows where they'll seek it elsewhere, and therefore the Torah provides kosher korbanos. At the risk of oversimplifying, that's a brief presentation of Rambam's position. Ramban says no, argues very fiercely against such an approach. They're not just responsive, and they're not just concessionary, and they're not just preventative. They are actively promoting something positive. Even if there was no such thing as avodah zara in the world, and there was no such worry that people would somehow stray after avodah zara, there's still room for the concept called korbanos. Now, as is, that is a pitched dispute. And interestingly, the Rambam seems to be of his own understanding, really propounding this position. It's one of those situations, Rambam against everyone. But Abarbanel, in his commentary on the Mor Nevuchim, he refers us to this medrash. In other words, Abarbanel says, you know, this doesn't start with the Rambam. This position of like a preventative or concessionary understanding of what korbanos are, it doesn't begin with the Rambam. He has ample source in the medrash, because it's this medrash which says, you see korbanos, right, they've got to be here, it's got to be monitored, there's a worry of avodah zara. That's Rambam. So that's important to note. Very often we have positions that are famous from Rishonim, but they're actually backed up by Chazal. You've got to know. It makes a difference. There's a few Ibn Ezra's, and Ibn Ezra is well capable of standing on his own two feet based on his understanding of the pasuk, but very often Ibn Ezra has a source in Chazal, and so too Rambam. That's what the Medrash says. However, and the reason why I mention it is, firstly, that should be known, but also perhaps there's room to say that this Medrash is not support for the Rambam. Why do I say that? Because the Medrash isn't, the way we've quoted it, the Medrash isn't explaining why there are korbanos. The Medrash is explaining why at that time no one could slaughter an animal that wasn't within the context of korbanos. In other words, it was only to reach out to the otherwise realm of the mundane, known simply as fleishiks, as a butcher, to say that needs to be brought within the context of korbanos, because of a worry that otherwise, left to their own devices, who knows what people may be intending. But beyond that, well, once that stops and you just have the quote-unquote normal program of korbanos, the Medrash isn't addressing that, but the Rambam was. And therefore I think it's a valid point to mention that as much as the Medrash is talking about the preventative aspect of korbanos, but it's only about how korbanos spread outwards to the mundane, but it's not about the actual circle of korbanos themselves at all, seemingly. At any rate, nachzor le'inyanenu, we have the concept again, what is known as basar taiva, just meat, just because people want to eat meat, which the Torah did not allow. It had to be brought as a korban. Interestingly, this, according to the Meshech Chochma, in a different section of the Parsha, is the underlying reason behind another fascinating Parshanut aspect of the Parsha. It brings us back to the Avodah of Yom Kippur. And we've discussed this at length in the past. We'll only bring it back to the extent that it ties into what we're saying here. There is a fascinating Medrash which tells us that, in fact, Aaron was entitled and allowed to enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim more than once a year, even not on Yom Kippur, provided he prepared himself with the order of korbanos that is described and discussed in our Parsha, in the beginning of Parsha Sacharimos. As if to say, what we refer to as the Avodah of Yom Kippur, which it is, for Aaron specifically, was not restricted to Yom Kippur. It was possible for Aaron to involve himself in this Seder Avodah on any day of the year, and thus to enter the Kodesh HaKadoshim. In the words of the Medrash, Kol eish sherotze yikones, yikones. When everyone stands, you can enter. Uvilvad sheyaseh keseder hazeh. As provided that he has the whole thing, the two se'irim, the two goats, the whole thing. And indeed, as Mefarshim point out, once again, from a certain point of view, the psukim bear this out. How so? A couple of very straightforward points. If you look through the Parsha Bacharemos, you will see that for almost all of the chapter, Tetzayim, it refers to Aaron. It doesn't refer to the Kohen. Now, you could say that it means Aaron representing, because he's the Kohen Gadol. Yes, but towards the end of the Perek, as it talks about L'chukas Olam, as it will be for all generations, it then moves and talks about the Kohen. In other words, the way to understand this is not that until now it's the Kohen that we know, called Aaron, and then in future generations it's the Kohen that you don't know, and it's all the same thing. It's not the same thing. In context, this chapter has a special meaning for Aaron. Personally, it's for him on any given day. By the end, for future generations, it's achas bashana. It's only once a year. And moreover, and again, a very compelling point, this perek and this parsha differ from every other time-based or time-stamped mitzvah, in the sense that with every other moed, the first thing the Torah does is it tells you what moed we're talking about, what day of what month are we talking about, and then tells you what the avodah should be. That's quite so. So you know from the maftirs of all the Yomim Tovim, Chodesh HaRishon, Be'echad HaChodesh, it's whatever. Sorry, Chodesh HaShvi, Be'echad HaChodesh is Rosh Hashanah. Chodesh HaRishon, B'chamishas LaChodesh, Pesach. The first thing we says, when are we, and then what happens? And amazingly, in Parshas Acharemos, there is a description over the course of, I think, 33 or 34 psukim of the Avoda, and there is no mention of when we are talking about. Until verse 32 or 33. It's only towards the end of the perek that the date is mentioned. And the reason why is because for most of the perek, it's not restricted to that date. It's not tied to that date. For Aaron, this can happen at any time. Once we get to Chukas Olam, once we get to Yom Kippur for future generations, past beyond Aaron, so at that point it's only once a year, and that's why everything is reversed. V'nafochu, the date comes in at the end. So the parsha changes towards the end as it becomes fixed for future Kohanim Gadolim. For them, it's just once a year. That's not true for Aaron. As if to say, for future Kohanim Gadolim, or more correctly, for subsequent Kohanim Gadolim, this is the parsha of Avodas Yom Kippur, what we call it. For Aaron, it was the parsha of the Avoda of entering the Kodesh HaKadosh. And the question, and this is a fascinating discussion in and of itself, and could very easily become the entire shir, there's many, many other aspects to discuss. But for our purposes, to ponder the question as to why Aaron would be different. As if to say, why would it be the case that for Aaron, he can come at any time? It could be very simply, it represents the exalted level of Aaron. Maybe he's in Yom Kippur mode, so to speak, the whole time. Maybe the Mishkan is in the Midbar is in Yom Kippur mode the whole time. Perhaps. But then the Meshech Chochmah says something very interesting. It's not widely discussed, but this very, very sensitive, these inner korbanos, what are called, the korbanos whose blood is sprinkled in the direction of the Aron, etc. and so forth. Those inner korbanos. What do they do? What are they for? They're sin offerings, many of them, which means that they're there to offer, to achieve kapara. Kapara for what? Now we might say, well, kapara for everything. But that's not so. The animal that gives kapara for everything is the seir that's sent away. Seir la'zozo. But what about those animals whose blood is sprinkled inside? They come, as the Gemara says in Maseches Shavuos, they come to atone for just one thing. And that is Tumas Mikdash V'Kadoshav. The possibility of impurity, something impure, having entered the Mikdash, having entered the environs of the Mikdash. It's a fascinating thing to behold. In fact, the Gemara says, all of the seasonal sin offerings are for that, which means every sin offering of Rosh Chodesh, which we just had today, and of every Yom Tov, and these additional ones of Yom Kippur, they're all for the same issue, the same problem of Tumas Mikdash B'Kadosh, the potential impurity of the Mikdash. It's an incredibly seemingly imbalanced situation. You have 612 other mitzvahs, they're all taken care of by one korban. And then you have this one issue called contamination of the Mikdash, and it needs roughly about 30 sin offerings on a yearly basis. It's very interesting. Why? Well, there's a lot to say about that, but clearly, as Mefarshim point out, the innermost part of the Jewish people is what requires the most protection. If the innermost part of the Jewish people, geographically, and all that that represents, experientially, becomes contaminated, That's worse than in some respects everything else put together, and therefore it needs this. It needs a regular atonement. The innermost point is the most sensitive point. Very interesting. Well, says Meshech Chochmah, once we appreciate that the situation in the Midbar was that no animal could be slaughtered and eaten outside the context of Karbonos, that means there was an unusual or disproportionately high level of Karbonos that were offered the whole time by everyone. Not necessarily because they felt like they wanted to bring a korban, but just that they felt like they wanted to consume this animal. And therefore, because you had a greater influx of people who may not have been as prepared, the susceptibility of the Mishkan to Tumah was much higher. And that's why there was a need to go through a cleaning much more frequently. And that, he suggests, again, to put it in one sentence, Basar Taiva meant there would be a greater convergence of all sorts of people in all sorts of states, perhaps, if they weren't careful enough in the Beis HaMikdash, which made it susceptible to a greater frequency of Tumah. That's why that required itself a greater frequency of Tahara through this Avoda. So that's his suggestion as to the why behind why Aaron could enter at any time. At any event.
Is there any indication that actually Aaron did enter?
Yes. The Medrash elsewhere, what we quoted is the Medrash by Yikra Rabbah. The Medrash in Shemos Rabbah states that he entered there regularly. And in fact, just a further digression, but all apropos, the final pasuk of Perek Tetzayin, after the whole Avodah is finished, states, Aaron did as Moshe commanded. Which, when you hear a pasuk like that, it seems to be stating the obvious. But the point is, there and then. He didn't wait for Yom Kippur. That's the point. And that's taken as even the pasuk referring to this phenomenon. To come back now to pasuk Gimel, which we've begun to explore, which says that if a person slaughters outside and doesn't bring it to the Mishkan. Now, says Ramban, in light of the Gemara statement that you could not slaughter an animal outside the context of Karbonos in the Mishkan. So then Pasuk Gimel and Dalet need to be reassessed accordingly. We would perhaps have understood the Pasuk says, look, if you shecht it, you don't bring it to the Korban, meaning it is a Korban and you don't bring it as a Korban, that's a problem. But the truth is, everything had to be brought as a Korban, which means that this Pasuk is talking about everything. If that point is clear. Once we understand that all Shechita had to be processed through and go through the process of Korbanos, so this Pasuk in context is talking about all Shechita. And that's why it doesn't say if a person brings a Korban, but then he shefts it outside, because all animals were brought as Korbanos at that time. And therefore the Pasuk is referring to any animal. Says Meshechachma. And with this, we're in Shvi'i. We're in the home stretch here. With this in mind, says Meshech Chachma, perhaps we can understand why it is that the Torah makes explicit reference to animals, but not to korbanos of birds, which was our question. The halacha is, it's equally true for a korban that's a bird. So if it's equally true, how come they don't get equal treatment or equal expression, equal plane of expression? The animal is mentioned explicitly, the bird from Midrasha, says Meshech Chachma, because we'll quickly appreciate that everything we just said, that you couldn't shecht anything and not bring it as a korban, it had to be brought as a korban, is only true for animals. It's not true for birds, for a simple reason. It couldn't work. There is no category of bird korban that it could work for. With regards to an animal, you can offer it as a korban. You can volunteer that it should be a korban, a shlomim, for example, a peace offering, and you get most of the animal back for supper. But when it comes to birds, there's only one type of korban that you can volunteer from oaf, and that is olas oaf. Olas oaf is burnt entirely on the mizbeach, so that's you're not going to get many temporal returns from that. The only type of bird korban that's consumed by people is a chatas, but you can't volunteer a chatas, and you don't want to volunteer a sin. And therefore, the arrangement whereby they can be streamlined into the category of korbanos only exists for animals, not for birds. And therefore, says Meshech Chachma, since, as Ramban is telling us, in this context, for the Bnei Yisrael, as they are receiving this pasuk, in the Midbar, it is stated for any type of shechita, That's why birds are not mentioned explicitly in the pasuk, because that's not true for birds. It isn't true that any type of shechita, it's specifically a korban. But when it comes to animals, the scope is broader, because no animal is allowed to be brought not as a korban, allowed to be slaughtered not as a korban. And therefore, to sum it all up, we see from this analysis of Meshech Chochma something that we have encountered on a number of occasions. Namely, there are certain messages that we receive from Pshuto Shel Mikra. There are certain messages we receive explicitly from the Pshat. There are other messages that we receive from Medrash Halacha, from Darshan Halacha. And sometimes they're not the same. And if they're not the same, then presumably one of them is the Halacha and another is something else. Another Torah message, but not necessarily the Halacha. Because if they're both Halacha, how come they're not the same? But sometimes they're not the same, and they're still both halacha. Because one represents halacha l'sha'a, halacha that was stated for that time specifically, and one represents halacha l'doros. And what's fascinating is, we have such a split in our pasuk, whereby what's mentioned explicitly in the pasuk, which is any type of shechita, is true for those things mentioned explicitly in the pasuk, namely animals, not birds. That is, that shape is fits halacha l'sha'a, because it applied to all animals, it didn't apply to all birds. And therefore the pshat chaps, the pshat gets the halacha l'sha'a, whereas it's the medrash halacha that gives us the picture, the enduring picture, halacha l'doros, and that's how the two go hand in hand. That is a masterful way of understanding this pasuk here. Well, we spent quite a bit of time on Parshas Acharemos, gone into a bit of new territory. I'd like to conclude by referring us to a mitzvah or pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, and that is Perek Yutes, pasuk Yud Zayin. The words that I'm sure are well known, and let's see what there is to say. Perek Yutes, pasuk Yud Zayin. Lo sisna sachicha bilvavecha. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Hochech tochecha samisecha. You shall rebuke your fellow. Velo sisa alav chet. And you shall not bear sin on his account. So we have two mitzvahs here, one negative, one positive, and then a follow-up admonition, shall we say. The negative mitzvah, don't hate your brother in your heart. And then we have a mitzvah. Now, two pertinent questions of the many that we could ask regarding this pasuk. Number one, what does the Torah mean by specifying, don't hate your brother in your heart? If it's not in your heart, is it okay? I mean, is this somehow defining or restricting the scope of the prohibition? Or what is it bringing to the occasion? Generally, people who hate, they hate in their heart. So that's how it starts. So why does the Torah add the word bilvavecha? Had it said, lo sisna sachicha, lo sisna sachicha. As surely as it doesn't say, you shall rebuke him with your mouth, because just says, okay, tochia. So why does it say, don't hate him in your heart? Secondly, what is the syntactical cohesion of the pasuk? What's the flow? Does A lead to B? Is A connected to B? Or B to A? Don't hate him, rebuke him. Do these two go together? Does one somehow inform the other? Well, as we will see, again, from classic Rishonim, there may be different approaches to these questions. The Ramban, in addressing the first question, and again, which was, why does the Torah say a bilvavecha? What does that teach me? Says Ramban, in his first approach, which is al derecha pshat, that the Torah says bilvavecha very simply because, well, almost the question becomes the answer, because that's what people hate. In his words, derech hasonim lisno belev, it's the way of people who hate, they hate with their heart, v'hakosuv diber behove. And the Torah describes things in the normal or prevalent way. Diber hakosuv behove. That's an expression Rashi uses it a number of times. It's from Chazal. That sometimes the Torah describes something not to restrict it to that domain, but just that's where typically where it will be. Which means according to Ramban, if a person hates someone, if you can envisage such a thing, and we may yet see how, if he hates his brother not in his heart, it's also a problem. Don't think it's okay because it's not in my heart. The Torah only forbade it in my heart. It's never okay. All right. And then what about Hocheach Tochiach Es Amisecha? Says Ramban, that's the mitzvah of Tochacha, you should rebuke him. And seemingly from Ramban, he doesn't pursue a connection between these two things. They're both important, it's both ben adam lechavero, but one isn't the product of the other, or influenced by the other, necessarily. Amazingly, as much as we may look at what the Ramban just said as rather straightforward and intuitive, the Rambam seems to have a different position, both in his Sefer HaMitzvos, and in the Mishnah Torah, in Hilchos Deos. the Ram, and it's based on the Torah's Kohanim, based on Chazal. Says Rambam, when the Torah says, Lusisna Sechicha Bilvavecha, which is an absolute negative prohibition, one of the 365, says Rambam, when does a person violate this prohibition? If he keeps it in his heart, it's specifically when it's Bilvavecha that it's Osir. Exactly what we were, in a sense, moving away from, Al Derech HaPshat for Ramban, says Rambam, no, that's the Halacha. It is only forbidden by the Torah when it's in your heart. But if it's not in your heart, now what does that mean? If it's not in your heart, because if you're not keeping it from him, what if you tell him? Even if you argue with him, and you tell him how much you dislike him, it's unpleasant. But you're no longer in violation of this prohibition. Why not? Well, as Mefarshim point out, the Teras Kohanim and after them the Rambam understand what is especially problematic here is that you have such a dislike for him and he doesn't know. In other words, if the coast is clear, if you're clear on your position, it's better to be friends. That's another thing called v'atenuecha kamocha. It's better to be friends. But he knows where he stands. He won't trust you maybe in something that he wouldn't trust you if he knew how you felt. So as long as your position is clear, you are clear of losisna sechicha b'vavecha. You should probably still address the issue, but it's no longer this prohibition. Wow. But what we do see in one form or another is that there is this prohibition, an amazing prohibition, if one may say, an amazing Torah prohibition, to hate someone. And hate is hatred, although normally these things are defined in halacha. We know how tall a sukkah should be, and we know how long a lulav should be in order to qualify. We don't know how intense hatred should be in order to disqualify. But presumably, it's anything in the wrong direction, in the area of dislike. Not acceptable. But this breeds actually a very interesting question in the Gemara, in Maseches Pesachim and Daf Kuf Yud Gimel. Why? Because the Torah elsewhere discusses two people who don't like each other. How so? If you see in Parshas Mishpatim, Lo tireh es ki tireh chamor sonacha raveitz tachas maso. What if you see the donkey of your enemy and it's stumbling or it's struggling under its load? You should help him. So the Gemara has an amazing question. Everyone else is wondering how much do you need to help him, etc. and so forth, and all of those parameters which are important. But the Gemara says, how can the Torah talk about your enemy? I thought you're not meant to have enemies. How can you have a sonar? The Torah asks it. It's not okay. It's like the Torah saying, you know, when you're eating, you're not kosher food. Here's what that's not an acceptable scenario to begin with. You shouldn't have enemies. Now, interestingly, one could say, perhaps deceptively simply, that the Torah didn't talk about if you see a person that you don't like. But if you talk about a person who doesn't like you, it says ki tireh chamor sonacha. Literally, sonacha means one who hates you. It's not my problem if he hates me. I'm not responsible for him. He shouldn't do it. But the Torah is not addressing me as doing something wrong. But interestingly, the Gemara doesn't go for that distinction. It's not comfortable with anyone hating anyone within all things being equal. and therefore, what's the resolution? Now, the Gemara's response to this also needs to be reckoned with, because the Gemara says, you know what? Sometimes it's acceptable to hate someone. Yiras Hashem sinas ra. The fear of God is the hatred of evil. Well, what does that mean? It means, says the Gemara, if you have seen this person sinning, and again, however sinning is defined in with whatever level of severity or whatever it is, if you've seen this person sinning, and you know the person doesn't, and that's how they are, so then they can be your enemy. And this too is codified by Rambam in Hilchos Rotzeach. Which doesn't sound very good, but in any case, in Hilchos Rotzeach, in towards the final halachas, and maybe that's part of the answer. You never know what comes from this. It starts with, but there are certain places, says Rambam, if you've seen a person who's been doing this wrongdoing, and says Rambam, you've rebuked him, and he doesn't listen, so it's mutter to hate him, and the Rambam says the mitzvah. Wow, all this needs to be quantified. And somehow understood correctly. The first thing, says Be'er Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Salant, the first thing to note is that the Rambam only spoke about a situation where you've seen this person commit an Aveira. Not if you haven't seen him. That's interesting. After all, what if a very reliable person told you that he did it? How has anything changed? You know, you're not meant to believe them. I mean, it's about Lashon Hara. But the point is, says Be'er Yosef, a person needs to protect themselves. As if to say, it is the nature of things. And important to recognize, as we do, the nature of things. That when a person sees someone else who violates one of his values, so that can impair one's sensitivity to those values. And that's not acceptable. As if to say, it's a very interesting comment that he makes. Sometimes when you protest someone who's violating something that you hold dear, it's not only for them to get the message, but it's also to reinforce the message for you. This isn't acceptable. And that means that the only grounds for this divide, which is called sina, which really in a sense is dislike, the only grounds is if you actually saw them. Why? It's not because if you didn't see them, you shouldn't believe that they did it. It's only when you see this that you are at risk in that sense, in trouble, that your values may be desensitized, and you're entitled, therefore, to take this compensatory reaction. That's number one. But number two, first response is to try and correct the situation. And in other words, that's where the Rambam says, if you saw a person who did this wrongdoing, and you have to rebuke them. If they didn't listen, so then it's a different story. But first is to rebuke them. Why? Because isn't that a better way, assuming you do it correctly, isn't that a better way to resolve the situation? Not so much that you distance yourself from them because they're wrong, make them right. And what does that mean? It means that it can never degenerate into a personal animosity. And that's a very difficult line to tread, obviously. It has to be this almost like an ideological dislike. But how do you know? And how can you ensure that? Well, you never really can. But number one, try and help them. And number two, says the Gemara, and that's why the Torah says, that phrases it in that way, as if to say, you know how you know that your hatred is pure in the good sense of the word? You'd still help that person if they're in trouble. Or more correctly, you'd still help their donkey if they're in trouble, because the donkey didn't do an Aveira. As if to say, that's why the Torah presents it in those terms. Sonacha, your legitimate enemy. Meaning someone who's done an Aveira, okay, but you've taken the root of having that dislike of him, but keep it pure. And you know how the Torah ensures that? Be sure to help him if he needs help. What, you're not going to help him? Doesn't mean that you condone what he did. You're not going to help him if he's in trouble? And moreover, the Gemara says that if you have, imagine you're met with a scenario of two people who need help, your enemy and your friend. And you have to choose, because you can't be in two places at once. Prioritize your enemy, says the Gemara. Why? To be sure that you curb your Yetzirah of your enmity to him. Except I thought it's a mitzvah to hate him. We're giving yes-no messages. You're told to hate him, and then you're told to treat your hatement of him. Yes, to be sure that it's correct, and not just a personal animosity. And that's why, says Be'er Yosef, if you look again into the word, Lo sisna sechicha bil vavecha, don't hate your enemy in your heart. And our question was, well, where is hatred if not in your brother in your heart? Where is hatred if not in the heart? But the word bilvavecha is an important word. How so? Because the Hebrew word for heart is lev, which means it could say belibcha. What is the difference between libcha, your heart, and levavecha, your heart? Well, as we know, when we say v'ahavtas Hashem elokecha b'chol levavcha, the Mishnah famously says, with your yetzer tov and your yetzer hara, you've got two hearts, your yetzer tov, your yetzer hara. Bring them both in to Avas Hashem, however that's meant to be done. That tells us the word bilvavecha means yetzer tov and yetzer hara. Libcha, the one base, is just the yetzer tov. That's why when Avram says to the angels, the sa'adu libchem, says Rashi, they don't have a yetzer tov, they don't have a yetzer hara. They're angels, so it's only libchem. So that's really what the pasuk is saying. Even when you finally have this license to distance yourself from someone as a response to their willful wrongdoing, maybe, but don't hate them with both parts of your heart. Don't hate them with your yetzer hara. Just hate them with your yetzer tov, if you can do that. Lo sisna sechicha bevavecha. And that, says Be'er Yosef, is why the pasuk goes on to say, hocheach tochiach es amisecha. Give them rebuke. Try and correct them. These two are connected. How so? Because if you really are hating them only with your yetzer tov, your ideal scenario is that they should do better. Help them to do better. If you hate them with your yetzer hara, you'll leave them. You'll leave them in your wrongdoing. And it's better even that way, because it's always geschmack to have someone to condemn in shul. So it almost ruins everything if you correct them and then they're not doing anything wrong. And then Shabbos is not the same. And that's the connection between these two. Lo sisna sechicha bevavecha. And you know what the litmus test is? Help him. Because if you hate him with your yetzer hara, you'll leave him to drown. But if you hate him only with your yetzer tov, you pull him out. You know, the Gemara says, talking about the Churban, that there's two conflicting statements. The famous Gemara says that the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. That's well known. But then that's in Daf Yuma and Daf Tes. But then the Gemara says in Shabbos and Kuf Yud Ches that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because they didn't rebuke each other. Says the Be'er Yosef, that's two sides of the same coin. If you hate a person just because, so then you won't rebuke him. And if he's doing wrong, you'll watch him. You'll watch him founder. And come to ruin. And this is really the enduring message of Lo sisna sechicha bevavecha. One could sum up by saying that the art of what the Torah is talking about, but the Gemara, the license to dislike a person, it's got to be with just the one base. Libcha, just with your yetzer tov. If you ever hate a person with two bases, you can be pretty sure that hatred has no basis. And as I think that the message is that we need to find a balance. In other words, what's not acceptable is to go to the other extreme, as if to say, we don't have any ill feeling towards anyone for doing something wrong, because we don't care about that they're doing something wrong. You know, so it can sometimes happen that a person feels that they're full of such love for people, regardless of what they do, but it's just because they don't care what the other person does. So they haven't even been violated or offended to have love overcome it. They've just been entertained. So it's just interesting, and they just have a natural, basic, low level of goodwill. The art of what the Torah is talking about here is that we should be upset, but that Avas Yisrael should overcome. And this, I think, is a very, very profound, timely and timeless message. Certainly, these are days where we're mindful of our presence here in Eretz Yisrael, is there any place where goodwill and harmony is necessary? It's in Eretz Yisrael. We say, Ata echad, Shimcha echad, Mikamcha Yisrael, Goyachad Ba'aretz. There's no place that we need more to be Goyachad than Ba'aretz. And the more that we, each one in our own way, promotes that in our own sphere, the more we should see the fulfillment of all the Besaros of the future to come in Mehir B'Aminu.